Bridget and Kane followed Shizuka along the shoreline. She was stopped a few times by agitated civilians who peppered her with panicky questions. She responded to them in a cool, calm tone that lessened the fear in the people's demeanors appreciably. Shizuka led the way across a pebble-strewed beach into a small cove, made almost invisible by foliage and the leafy boughs of trees drooping on either side. The three of them waded through the shallows until they saw a long shape humping up from the water. Bridget and Kane turned on their Nighthawk microlights and cast the amber beams on the big oblong shape resting in the water.
A submarine?
Not exactly. It's a Kobuk-son.
Exactly.
What the hell is a Kobuk-son?
Bridget translated.
A turtle ship.
As he drew closer to it, Kane realized the vessel was aptly named. Although the vessel's streamlined contours bore some resemblance to the submarine he had seen on Ambika's Isle of the Lioness, what he had mistaken for a conning tower was actually more of a figurehead. Rising from near the bow, it was a stylized representation of a horned dragon's head, baleful and demonic of expression. Its fanged jaws hung open in a ferocious snarl. Kane ran his hands over the ship's hull. The planking felt like tough pine, almost as hard as iron. The entire top deck was enclosed by a hexagonal framework that gradually rose amidships to give the appearance of a turtle shell. Within the 3-foot-wide frames gleamed tightly linked steel mesh. All the ship's lines were gently rounded, and even the figurehead blended into its overall gracefulness. He guessed its overall length at around 30 feet.
It was built at the direction of Lord Takaun.
Why?
It's the next best thing to an ironclad. Actually, a turtle ship like this was probably the first ironclad.
Kane was interested in spite of himself.
What do you mean?
In the 16th century, Japan was torn by civil strife. A shogun named Oda Nobunaga managed to temporarily call a truce among the warring clans and houses. He was assassinated, and Toyotomi Hideyoshi rose to power in 1590. Hideyoshi's problem was to find a way to weaken the powerful feudal lords of the western part of Japan. In this explosive domestic situation, he looked abroad and decided that an invasion of China would provide the outlet needed for a peaceful solution at home. He sought Korea's aid in this undertaking.
I see.
When Korea rejected Hideyoshi's request for aid in attacking China, he ordered his generals to invade Korea in 1592. The Japanese army, armed with matchlock guns with which Korean soldiers were not familiar, reached Seoul within 2 weeks. They had attempted to invade the Granary province of Jeollado, only to meet the strong resistance of the people, led by General Kim Shi-min at Jinju. Then they turned back towards Seoul.
Shizuka looked expectantly toward Bridget.
You seem passingly familiar with my country's history. Do you know what happened next?
Bridget smiled wryly.
Korea's King Sonjo and the royal princes fled to the northern provinces and appealed to the Ming Emperor for aid against the invaders. The Japanese generals squabbled among themselves, while Korean Admiral Yi Sun-shin conducted a brilliant series of operations in the Korean Straits, destroying many Japanese ships. The ironclad Kobuk-son, which Admiral Yi improved with plated armor resembling a turtle shell, protected the sailors and marines and was more than a match for anything else afloat.
Kane glanced over his shoulder at Shizuka.
And the Japanese then borrowed the design?
She nodded.
And this one is almost an exact duplicate of the one that defeated the Japanese Navy. Lord Takaun personally selected all the wood. The ribs are of oak, and the pine planks were made pliant by steaming them over boiling seawater.
She shrugged.
It was something of a hobby of his, but the ship is also functional. He named it the Gamiramaru.
Does that name have any historical significance?
Mythological, perhaps. Before Skydark, there was a body of legends about a giant fire-breathing turtle that acted as the guardian of Nippon.
Kane walked the length of the turtle ship, stepping over the mooring lines, noting, with a degree of dismay, the rust pitting the metal mesh within the framework. At its bow, he nearly tripped over a long ramming sprit just below the surface. It was about 12 feet in length, made of sturdy oak and wrapped with hammered-out strips of metal wound around it for reinforcement. The shaft terminated in a broad-bladed iron triangle, like a plowshare. He turned to Shizuka.
How does this thing move? I don't see any sails or oarlocks. What does it use? Hamsters on a treadmill?
If Shizuka understood his comment, she didn't react to it.
It's powered by a diesel engine.
Kane whirled toward her.
Diesel engine? Does it work? Do you have fuel?
She gestured toward the vessel.
See for yourself, Kane-san.
He circled the turtle ship, splashed through the water, and found where prop blades protruded astern. Following Shizuka's instructions, he opened a hatch on the starboard side aft and heaved himself into the interior. The moonlight coming through the chain-link mesh had a honeycomb pattern, but he saw the vessel was smaller than he expected from the outside. He figured the beam was narrower because the Gamera Maru's speed and maneuverability were more important than a smooth ride. Three rows of wooden benches were bolted to the deck, and in the bow he saw a large copper cauldron sitting on stone blocks. A wide-mouthed pipe with tin skirting hung over the pot and angled upward. The contents of the cauldron exuded a strong, astringent odor, which he could even taste.
What's in this pot?
You should be able to smell that for yourself. A mixture of sulfur and saltpeter. When it's ignited, it produces a smoke screen.
Examining the pipe, Kane saw how it funneled up through the hollow throat of the dragon figurehead. The smoke would pour from its mouth, which he thought was appropriate, since the vessel was named after a fire-breathing turtle. He saw how the bulkheads were perforated with ob and weapons ports. A mast was stowed away in a crutch below the deck, but was easily pulled out and stepped into its socket with the aid of massive oaken wedges. The sail, unlike those on the junks, was a square of coarse white linen. Takaun had taken into consideration the possibility of running out of fuel while at sea. At the rear of the ship, he found an ancient engine block and unscrewed the lid to the fuel tank. The dipstick showed it was about 3/4 full. He checked the oil sump and found it full.
I'm going to give it a try.
Go ahead.
He thumbed the priming button several times. Bracing his feet, he jerked the starting cord. But nothing happened. He yanked again and again. After the third failure, he checked the plugs, the coil wires, and the choke. He pumped the prime again, then grasped the cord tightly by its handle, held his breath, and pulled violently. With a staccato pop-popping, the engine roared to life, the props churning the water to a froth. Noxious fumes floated from the exhaust as the turtle ship slid forward, then came to a stop when it reached the end of the mooring lines. Kane managed to figure out how to steer the ungainly craft with a rudder handle and a crude wheel. He experimented with a motor, increasing the RPM, the thudding growl of the pistons rising in volume. The ship probably could achieve 20 knots on calm seas. To turn off the engine, he worked a jury-rigged throttle made of wire and springs and closed off the fuel pump. The motor made a wheezing gasp and died. Kane climbed out of the hatch and rejoined Bridget and Shizuka on the shoreline.
What's the average crew complement of the Gamera Maru?
Shizuka shook her head.
I know she can comfortably fit a dozen people. We sailed on her to Port Morninglight.
Where'd you get the sulfur and saltpeter?
Here. It's in abundance. This is a volcanic island, after all.
A half-smile lifted one corner of Bridget's mouth.
Then you're not quite as outgunned as you may think.
How so?
Kane took her by the elbow, guiding her back toward the quayside.
Show us what else Nuedo has in abundance, and we'll let you know.
The horizon was as thin as a pencil line and seemed to curve slightly downward. Despite the rising sun, the sea was gray and the sky was gray. Ramirez felt as if the CG-47 were pressed between the two. He saw nothing but inestimable miles of uninterrupted, heaving gray. Thunder rumbled, the wind picked up, and the ocean swells grew. Still, the cruiser cut a foaming path through the boiling sea on a direct heading toward the strait. A loud boom of thunder exploded, and the air shivered with its vibration like the striking of a gong. Lightning crowded the sky, the brilliant flash turning the dim gray dawn to a blazing high noon. A moment later, a howling squall hit the cruiser broadside. It tossed the ship about as if she were a twig caught in rapids. The CG-47 bucked and slammed up and down. A swell peaked like a wet mountain beneath the keel, and the cruiser slid down it. The ship tobogganed to the next gray-green mountain that loomed up out of the sea. Ramirez gripped the railing with all the strength in his hands, afraid to glance over his shoulder at the wheelhouse. If Carpenter the pilot failed to keep the ship's bow up, the CG-47 would wallow, take on water, and go swiftly to the bottom. The pumps worked steadily, yet all the while, more of the sea sluiced over the deck and into the bilge. Ramirez saw one of his men clinging to a stanchion like a barnacle on a rock. The mag quickly became violently seasick. His complexion turned as greenish-gray as the sea. His shoulders heaved, and he vomited until there was nothing left in his stomach but burning acids. The waves rinsed the deck clean. A voice filtered into his ear through the helmet's comm link, but it was so hashy with static he couldn't understand a word. Carefully, he turned to look at the elevated bridge housing, and he saw Carpenter at the wheel gesturing to him. Clenching his teeth, Ramirez pushed himself away from the rail just as another huge wave buffeted the CG-47. Ramirez stumbled, and he saw the sick magistrate lose his grip and roll across the foredeck, tumbling like a log. Ramirez reached for him, but a wave surged over the deck, engulfed him, and he was gone. Ramirez opened his mouth to roar out an obscenity, but a bucketful of seawater struck him directly in the face. He coughed and sputtered and spit and left the rail, heading toward the bridge. Despite the thick treads of his boots, he staggered and slid on the deck plates, gracelessly falling on his rear end more than once. He crawled to the ladder leading to the wheelhouse and pulled himself up the rungs, his wet gloves slipping on the railing. Once inside the cabin, he breathed deeply with relief. A handful of his mags were present, and they all appeared both frightened and motion sick. There were 20 magistrates aboard, and even those from Snakefish in the cabins below decks possessed little hard seamanship experience. Ramirez could only hope that by the time they squeezed through the strait, they wouldn't be too busy throwing up to achieve their mission objective. Carpenter, a man with a weather-beaten face and ash-blonde hair, spoke flatly from his place at the wheel.
The seas are so rough we may pile up inside the passage. We could wait until the storm passes.
How long will that be? Ramirez stumbled as the cruiser pitched to starboard. Carpenter shrugged.
I couldn't say.
You're the official pilot of this boat.
Ship.
So you know better than anybody what it can take and what it can't.
Carpenter's leathery lips compressed.
I've never been in these seas before, but I do know this. The Baron loves this ship. If she's scuttled, if she's sunk, if she's wrecked, all of us better go down with her. Baron Snakefish won't listen to any excuses about how she was lost.
Ramirez's belly turned a cold flip-flop, but not from seasickness. He knew full well that Carpenter spoke the truth. Regardless of the mission the Baron had assigned him, Ramirez was expected to return the cruiser to the Ville more or less in the same shape in which it had left. He was positive the New Edoans were aware of their presence by now. And if Kane, Grant, and the renegade historian Baptiste were there, they would have told them what they could expect in the way of opposition. Still, he knew from the onset, based on the intel Carpenter had provided, that it would be impossible to approach the island unseen. They wouldn't be able to sneak in through the strait unchallenged and unopposed. Another huge wave crashed over the prow of the CG-47, and Carpenter wrestled with the wheel. He decreased the RPM of the two turbine engines, and the boat shook with a stem-to-stern vibration. The wipers flicked steadily back and forth, but they were unable to keep the windshield clear for more than a microsecond at a time. One of the mags suddenly bent forward and vomited. No one paid him any attention, and Ramirez didn't rebuke him. He was glad to be in the stuffy bridge rather than down below or on deck. Then, as the CG-47 rode the crest of a swell, Ramirez saw dead ahead the vague outline of the strait. He guessed it was only 100 yards away and wouldn't have been visible through the mist and flying spray except for dim lights on the far side of it.
Make up your mind. Are we going to thread the needle or not?
Ramirez swallowed hard. He understood that regardless of Baron Snakefish's affection for the boat, ship, he wouldn't countenance the mag force turning back after reaching the very doorstep of their goal. We go. Carpenter turned the wheel.
Aye, aye, sir.
The ship's bow turned toward the opening, and the craft picked up speed, although the engines were still coasting on low revs. Carpenter responded to Ramirez's questioning look.
We're caught in the current, the undertow. I expected as much. It's apt to get rougher.
Plucking a microphone from the instrument panel, Ramirez opened the channel to all of the ship's sections. We are going through the strait. Everyone stow your equipment and hang on. The gap between the bastions of rock seemed to widen. With appalling suddenness, it became a gushing channel swirling around broken rocks, spray rising like mist. Carpenter spun the wheel to port, then to starboard. The ship quivered, then flew like an unguided missile into the heart of the foaming, churning passage. Ramirez braced himself tightly on the edges of the plotboard as the CG-47 arrowed into the wild current. Mist and foam completely covered the windshield. The cruiser plunged madly along the strait between the towering, kelp-draped walls of the cliffs. It pitched and yawed as it picked up speed, shooting forward, threading its way between upthrusts of pitted rock. The deck was saturated by the crashing waves and flying foam. The current seemed to draw the CG-47 forward like a toy at the end of a string. The cruiser's prow cleaved through the narrow channel like a knife blade. Ramirez prayed the high speed in shallow water wouldn't have the very possible effect of putting the ship's stern down to touch the bottom and smother the spinning props in the sand. Expertly handled by Carpenter, the CG-47 rushed down the strip of water between the two high ramparts of dark stone. Ramirez heard the scream of metal as the hull scraped the walls. The vessel shuddered under the glancing impact, but kept on going. Seconds later, she bucked heavily to starboard as her bow smashed sideways into a rock. The pilot spun the wheel, veering away, and sent her back on course with no slackening of her speed. She raced on through, heading clear and free toward the open water beyond the strait. The frothing sea calmed the farther the ship moved down the throat of the passage. The end of it was in sight. Within seconds, it seemed to Ramirez the cruiser barely moved.
The worst of it is behind us.
Ramirez didn't even try to suppress his sigh of relief. He spoke into the microphone.
We're through. All hands on deck. Standard deployment of arms and personnel. Prepare the landing boats.
On the heels of his last order came the sharp crack of an explosion. For an instant, he thought it was a thunderclap. Then a torrent of stone rained from above, completely obliterating any view of what lay beyond the strait. Grant had certainly spent worse nights out in the open than the one he suffered atop the plateau, but his discomfort wasn't simply physical. He lay under a sheltering fern atop one of the futons provided by the outpost guards, so he wasn't too uncomfortable. Through the foliage, he gazed up at the starlit sky, absently noting how the scudding clouds thickened across the face of the moon. The breeze carried the faint whiff of ozone, and he guessed a storm front was moving in. He knew he should have been exhausted, both from the battle and the climb, not to mention his lovemaking with Shizuka, but he couldn't force himself to sleep. He had trained himself to catch sleep whenever he could, so as to build up a backlog in case he had to go for long periods without it. But this night, he could barely nap, much less drift off into deep slumber. His mind raced like an out-of-control engine, thoughts, memories, and images careening wildly within the walls of his skull. One image predominated. An Outlander girl, barely 5 feet tall, slender yet curvaceous of build. He had no idea of Domi's true age. He was pushing 40 and felt twice as old. Still, he could never deny he was attracted to her youthfulness, her high spirits, and her uninhibited sexuality. But more than that, Domi had proved herself to be a tough and resourceful, if not altogether stable, partner. He realized he had never really known her. It hadn't occurred to him they had forged a relationship deeper than he knew or cared to admit. Always before, he had tried to make the gap in their ages the reason he didn't want to get involved with her, sexually or otherwise. Domi had been patient and understanding for a year until she grew tired of waiting. In truth, Grant had deliberately maintained a distance between himself and Domi so that if either she or he died, or simply went away, the vacuum wouldn't be so difficult to endure. He recalled with crystal clarity what she had said to him a month or so ago when she confronted him.
If you can't do it, if you're impotent, then let me know right now so I can make plans.
Grant angrily denied a physical disability was the reason.
Then it is me, you lying sack of shit. Big man, big chest, big shoulders, legs like trees. Guess they don't tell the story, huh?
Contempt dripped from every syllable. That was the last private conversation they had. Her angry outburst cut him like the knife she had turned on Guanateague. When he remembered the recrimination in her voice, he knew he couldn't make up for anything he had done to hurt her. And he knew he had hurt Domi dreadfully when she spied him and Shizuka locked in a passionate embrace. He didn't speak to her about it. Domi would never know how much she meant to him. She had died feeling used and discarded. Guilt and self-loathing filled him. Grant's eyes stung and his throat constricted. He breathed harshly but regularly until the tension in his throat relaxed. He wiped his eyes and thought about Shizuka. Although she was closer to his own age and much more mature than Domi, he realized bleakly her heart and soul were inextricably bound to New Edo. Those ties were even stronger now after the death of Kiyomasa and the incapacitation of Lord Takaun. She would never leave as long as she perceived New Edo needed her. The notion of remaining on the Little Island Monarchy definitely appealed to him, but Shizuka hadn't mentioned it to him, and Grant didn't feel it was his place to raise the issue with her. And if by chance she ever did make the proposition to him, and he accepted, he was fairly certain Kane would accuse him of desertion, despite the fact he had taken no vows or sworn oaths of service to battle the barons. Besides, judging by what Baron Sharp had revealed to him and Bridget during their meeting in Las Vegas, the involvement of Cerberus in overthrowing the barons might not be necessary at all. The baronies were poised on the brink of civil war, sparked by one of their own. If so, the strife had its roots thousands of years in the past. Grant had believed the barons were under the sway of the Archon Directorate, a non-human race who influenced human affairs for thousands of years. In fact, Lakesh claimed the entirety of human history was intertwined with the activities of the entities called Archons, although they were referred to by many names over many centuries. Angels, demons, visitors, ETs, saucer people, greys. Beginning at the dawn of human history, the Archons, subtly, and sometimes not so subtly, influenced human affairs. The concept of humanity as a slave race, owned by some mysterious power, was expressed thousands of years ago in humankind's earliest recorded religious and historical texts. Allegedly, the sinister thread linking all of humankind's darkest hours led back to a non-human presence that conspired to control humanity through political chaos, staged wars, famines, plagues, and natural disasters. The nuclear apocalypse of 2001 was all part of the Archon Directorate's strategy. With the destruction of social structures and severe depopulation, the Archons established the Nine Barons and distributed pre-dark technology among them to consolidate their power over Earth and its disenfranchised, spiritually beaten human inhabitants. Lakesh believed the conspiracy continued to the present, aided and abetted first by willing human allies and then the hybrid barons, their plenipotentiaries on Earth. The gene pool of the barons was a collection of superior traits derived from both human and Archon DNA. The supposed goal of the Directorate and the Barons was the unification of the world under their complete control, with all non-essential and non-productive humans eliminated. Nearly 200 years after the nuke cost, that objective had almost been achieved. The small population was easier to manipulate. But unification wasn't as easy to sustain as it was to gain. But over the past few months, all of them had learned that the elaborate explanation was a ruse. Bits of truth mixed with outrageous fiction. The Archon Directorate didn't exist except as a vast cover story created in the 20th century and embellished with each succeeding generation. The only so-called Archon on Earth was Balam, the last of an extinct race that had once shared the planet with humankind. After 3 years of imprisonment in the Cerberus Redoubt, Balam finally revealed the truth behind the Directorate and the hybridization program initiated centuries before. Balam claimed that the Archon Directorate existed only as an appellation and a myth created by the pre-dark government agencies as a control mechanism. Lakesh referred to it as the Oz effect, wherein a single vulnerable entity created the illusion of being the representative of an all-powerful body. Balam himself may have even coined the term Archon to describe his people. In ancient Gnostic texts, Archon was applied to a parahuman world-governing force that imprisoned the divine spark in human souls. Cain had often wondered over the past few months if Balaam had indeed created that appellation as a cryptic code to warn future generations. Even more shocking was Balaam's assertion that he and his ancient folk were of human stock, not alien, but alienated. They still didn't know how much to believe. But if nothing else, none of the Cerberus personnel any longer subscribed to the fatalistic belief that the human race had had its day and only extinction lay ahead. Balaam had indicated that wasn't true, only another control mechanism. Regardless of scraping away the myth and exposing the truth, the Barons, the half-human hybrids spawned from Balaam's DNA, still ruled. Although all of the fortress cities, with their individual allegedly immortal god kings, were supposed to be interdependent, the baronies still operated on insular principles. Cooperation among the barons was grudging, despite their shared goal of a unified world. They perceived humanity in general as either servants or as living storage vessels for transplanted organs and fresh genetic material. The barons weren't immortal, but they were as close as flesh-and-blood creatures could come to it. Due to their hybrid metabolisms, their longevities far exceeded those of humans. Barring accidents, illnesses, or assassinations, the Barons' lifespans could conceivably be measured in centuries. Grant figured that even the youngest of them was close to 100 years old. But the price paid by the Barons for their extended lifespans wasn't cheap. They were physically fragile, prone to lethargy, and their metabolisms were easy prey for infections, which was one reason they tended to sequester themselves from the vil-bred humans they ruled. In severe cases, even damaged organs were replaced from the storage banks of stockpiled organic material. The full scope of the medical procedures and treatments was unknown. What was not an unknown was how the vast genetic engineering facility beneath the Archuleta Mesa in Dulsa had served as a combination of gestation, birthing ward, and medical treatment center. The hybrids, the self-proclaimed new humans, were born there, the half-human spawn created to inherit the nuke-scoured Earth. None of the hybrids reproduced in conventional fashion. They reproduced by a form of cloning and gene splicing, but it hadn't seemed reasonable they would rely completely on the subterranean facilities beneath the Archuleta Mesa. And if that were so, if they didn't have access to a secondary installation, then extinction for the Barons was less than a generation away. Or so Grant and all the Cerberus exiles fervently hoped, with the Dulsa installation now destroyed. That hope vanished quickly when Lakesh informed them of the Area 51 complex and the body of legends that claimed alien involvement with the top-secret facility. The so-called aliens weren't referred to by name, but they fit the general physical description of Balaam's people. If that was indeed the case, Lakesh theorized that the medical facilities that might exist in Area 51 would be of great use to the Barons, since they would already be designed for their metabolisms. Baron Cobalt could reactivate the processing and treatment center without having to rebuild from scratch. He could have transferred the medical personnel from the Dulsa facility. Grant repressed a shudder when he recollected his conversation with Baron Sharp, who essentially confirmed Lakesh's hypothesis. Sharp declared that Baron Cobalt's forces had occupied the Dreamland complex and proposed doling out the means of baronial survival as he saw fit.
He vexed the Barons with an ultimatum, you see, to place him in a position of final authority as the Imperator, or die.
Imperator. Grant rolled the title around in his drowsy mind. During Kane's captivity in Area 51, he'd been told about a mysterious figure called the Imperator who intended to set himself up as overlord of the Vils, with the Barons subservient to him. That bit of news was surprising enough, but it quickly turned shocking when Kane said his informant claimed none other than Balaam, whom they had thought was gone forever, supported this so-called Imperator. Grant closed his eyes and beckoned sleep. To his distant surprise, he felt himself drifting off. He was awakened almost immediately, it seemed, by a spatter of cold rain, followed by the rumble of thunder. He opened his eyes and groggily raised his wrist cron to his face. According to the LED, the time was close to 5 o'clock a.m. He had slept for more than 7 hours, but he didn't feel particularly rested and certainly not refreshed. As he pushed himself up on his elbows, thunder boomed again, this time sounding much closer. Lightning flickered briefly in the cloud-clogged sky. The boom bled off into the sudden tolling of the alarm bell. Galvanized by the clanging and with his heart pounding, he struggled to his feet, wincing as his cuts twinged. He surveyed the sky, seeing the mountainous thunderhead skimming out of the east, almost blotting out the rising sun. The floating, billowing mass thickened rapidly, casting deep shadow over the entire plateau, bringing a sudden and oppressive gloom. The atmosphere seemed to gain weight, pressing against his eardrums, making respiration labored. The stormy blackness slowly spread like a blanket. Another thunderclap made the rocks underfoot tremble. Antoku rushed up to him from the vicinity of the watchtower, barking into the small comm unit in his hand. Even over the brassy ringing of the bell, Grant heard Mori's agitated voice speaking frantically over the transceiver. Breathlessly, Antoku translated.
Mori reports the ship is underway, on a direct heading with the strait. The seas are very rough this morning, so it's moving slowly. We have a little time.
Grant only nodded and climbed down into the cleft leading to the cramped cavern. By the lantern light, he noted with approval the guardsman had removed all the support stakes and braces from the stone wall. He nudged it with a foot, and the rocks shifted. Peering down into the strait, he saw nothing but darkness. Although the sun was higher, the heavy cloud cover prevented its light from penetrating the channel. The morning sky was the dismal color of old lead. The wind increased, and within moments it howled along the cliff face, whistling eerily through the crevices and cracks. Craning his neck, Grant looked toward the overhang where he had planted the grens. They were invisible in the gloom. He withdrew back into the cave, fervently hoping that by the time the ship entered the strait, the light would be stronger. If not, he figured he could hose bullets from his sin-eater in the general vicinity of the grens and hope for a lucky shot. The guardsmen and the tigers of heaven whispered urgently among themselves, fidgeting with their katanas, which were about as useful at the moment as a sticky with a manicure.
No need to get so wired up. They'll get here when they get here, if at all.
For a few minutes, Mori kept them updated on the cruiser's progress over the comm, but as the wind strengthened and drizzle became a raging downpour, the transmissions became garbled and finally ceased altogether. They waited out the storm in the little cave, wincing at the near-deafening claps of thunder and flinching from lightning strokes so frighteningly close, Grant fancied he felt his hair standing on end due to the static electricity. As the storm lashed at the plateau, even Grant grew nervous and impatient. There wasn't enough space in the hollowed-out room to pace, so he contented himself with first cracking his knuckles, then drumming his fingers on the rock wall. At length, the front moved off, the wind lessened in its fury, and the rain tapered to a drizzle. The dark mass of cloud slowly broke up, allowing weak sunlight to filter through. It took his eyes a moment to adjust to the gloom of the strait, and he could barely make out the storm-tossed whitecaps and the dark water far below. He wouldn't have seen the ship at all except for the lights feebly glowing through the window of the wheelhouse. The comm in Antoku's hand suddenly blared with Mori's frantic voice.
He can't see the ship!
Grant pointed downward.
I can, and here she comes.
Grant leaned against the wall, hazarding a peek down. The tigers and the guardsmen crowded around him, elbowing one another. They pushed Grant against the wall, and he felt it shift beneath his weight, dislodging a few of the smaller stones. With a curse, he pushed them back.
Spread out. One at a time, or you'll be on the ship's deck.
The men took turns gazing down at the cruiser as it eased past the mouth of the channel. They uttered hissing whispers of fear and anger and stepped back, instinctively clutching at their swords. A couple of them glared at him in silent accusation. Grant ignored them and leaned over the fortification, squinting as the last of the wind-whipped rain dampened his face. From below arose the strong odor of brine. Silently, he watched as the churning waters of the strait pummeled and buffeted the cruiser, lifting it, dropping it, and smashing it sideways against one wall. More than once he expected to see the vessel pile up against the rocks, but each time a head-on collision was avoided. As it was, he heard the tortured screech of metal against stone, echoing like the cry of a damned soul. He felt a moment's grudging admiration for the skill of the ship's pilot. The sea calmed as the cruiser progressed into the channel. Grant tensed as it approached the net spanning the width of the passage. The prow struck it dead center, and as he had anticipated and predicted, the ship's weight and momentum ripped the net loose from its moorings. Cables snapped with loud, semi-musical twangs, and wood splintered from the armatures with prolonged cracks.
Everybody out! Move a fair distance away. It's time to test my brilliant plan. Signal the others to get ready.
Swiftly, the guardsmen and the Tigers of Heaven climbed up the rope ladder and out of the cave. Grant leaned farther out over the wall, looking up. He gusted out a sigh of relief when his eyes picked out the grens jammed in the fissures. He flexed his wrist tendons and the Sin Eater slapped solidly into his waiting palm. Carefully, he brought one gray-shelled egg into target acquisition, took and held a breath, then squeezed the trigger. The 9mm round penetrated the thin metal shell, and the overhang dissolved in a blinding flash, a clap of thunder, and a booming burst of hell-hued light. The other two grins detonated almost simultaneously. Grant ducked back into the cave and rushed for the cleft and the rope ladder as the air shivered with the echoes of the explosions. Ugly black fissures spread out in a spiderweb pattern around the cleft. Dust and rock sifted down from above. He looked back once to see the entire cliff face in roaring motion. Rocks struck the wall and sheared it away, breaking it apart in hundreds of smaller pieces. As Grant struggled up the ladder, the entire section of the cliff that held the cave collapsed with an ear-splitting roar. Tons of rock plunged downward and very nearly carried him with it. Grant secured a tight double-fisted grip on the bamboo rungs, but his legs flailed for a foothold. He spit out grit and his eyes watered from dust. The avalanche roared and rumbled into a continuous thunder. Pelted by stones, stung by pebbles, he dangled at the end of the ladder over the strait. Slowly, he heaved his body up, chinning himself on a rung. There was a crack of splitting rock, and Grant felt one side of the ladder slipping downward. He fought to dig the toes of his boots into the hard volcanic rock. Then a hand closed over his right wrist. Grant tilted his head back, blinking, and saw Entoku lying belly down with the rock rim in his armpits.
"Grab me with your other hand!"
Grant seized his wrist, and Entoku said a few sharp words over his shoulder. The other men held Entoku by the ankles, and they began to back away from the cliff. Grant didn't try to pull. With his greater weight, he probably could have pulled Entoku and the others right down into the strait. By the time Grant was lifted to the point where he could rest his weight on the ladder, Antoku's limbs quivered violently with the strain. Grant heaved himself up, threw an arm over the ledge, then pulled his body over. For a long minute, all anyone could do was pant and gasp. When he recovered sufficient wind to do so, he spoke.
"Thanks."
The new Aedoans nodded casually, as if what they had accomplished were nothing to expend words of gratitude about. Grant didn't stand. He sat and tried to catch his breath, looking across the channel to the fortification on the opposite rampart. The guardsmen there had kicked and shoved their stone wall down into the chasm. So now his part of the plan was complete. If the next step, whatever Kane might have concocted, worked as well, the invasion would be decisively met and repulsed. The battle would be over. He earnestly hoped so. He was very tired. From Ramirez's vantage point, the catastrophe arrived between one heartbeat and another. He felt numb, completely disassociated from his body and surroundings. It was as if his mind hovered high above the CG-47 and observed the disaster with a kind of aloof bemusement. A roaring, seething avalanche of rock slabs and dirt cascaded down the steep face of the cliff, augmenting its bellowing fury with tons of stone torn loose by its rush. Great crags and shards rained on the deck of the cruiser, smashing, pulverizing, and crushing anything beneath it, including the few men who had ventured out on deck after the storm. Tons of granite and shale thundered down on the CG-47, boulders rolling and bouncing. Dimly, above the grinding rumble, Ramirez heard the terrified screams of the magistrates in the wheelhouse as they backed up against the far bulkhead. He watched in open-mouthed astonishment as a boulder the size of a landing boat tumbled end over end toward the wheelhouse. Fragments rattled violently against the walls, and Ramirez felt several sharp blows against his upraised armored arms. A flying splinter of glass nicked his chin, and suddenly, as if he had been booted in the rear, he was back in the bridge room again, not floating above it. Ramirez flung himself backward, wedging himself in a corner between the doorframe and the wall, paralyzed by terror and shock. Carpenter began to bellow, to curse and wrestle with the wheel, but it did no good. The CG-47 shuddered brutally under the barrage of falling stone. The lights in the wheelhouse flickered, the ship rocked to and fro, and Ramirez had to grab one of his men to keep him from staggering into the pilot. They fought each other to the open door. Under other circumstances, Ramirez would have shouted orders to bring his men under control. Instead, he made only gagging noises, his eyes blinded by hot tears. He felt a stream of urine scorching its way down his leg. The wheelhouse shook with such violence his teeth clattered. Fissures spread out on the ceiling. The bulkheads buckled and the ceiling cracked, split in the middle, and folded inward in a shower of debris. Ramirez kicked himself away from the corner as a seething cascade of metal braces, lathwork, and insulation rained to the deck. He caught only a fleeting glimpse of the pile of wreckage covering Carpenter and the other magistrates. His shoulder slammed the door open, and Ramirez toppled unceremoniously past the ladder, landing on his right side with a clatter of polycarbonate. His helmeted head smacked sharply against the deck plates. Air exploded from between his lips, and multicolored spirals spun before his eyes. A rock the size of a pumpkin hurtled over his head and smashed into pieces against the superstructure. Ramirez elbowed himself to his knees, then used the rungs of the ladder to achieve a crouching posture. He dragged air into his laboring lungs, swung his head up, and saw that the wave of shattered stone sweeping down the cliff face was bleeding itself out. He sheltered himself, as best he could, from flying fragments, although a couple of fist-sized chunks of granite rebounded painfully from his shoulders. He crouched there as the ship heaved and trembled around him. The shuddering crash of tumbling, rolling rock slowly faded. Cautiously standing, he peered through the thick wall of rising dust at the high heap of shale and boulders completely blanketing the deck. Ramirez looked beyond the CG-47's bow and saw an open expanse of fairly calm water. The ship was through the strait and in a natural bay. Rather than sighing with relief, he froze in fear. A flotilla of strange-looking ships hove out of the dust and the early morning murk. They encircled the CG-47. Two of them rode high in the water, their sails filled with the wind. They had a peculiar, lacquered appearance. One was a bit longer and broader in the beam than the other, but both ships were essentially identical. He caught only a glimpse of the third ship, and unlike the others, it was low-slung, with no superstructure to speak of. He was irresistibly reminded of a giant turtle, but then its shape was lost by wreaths of yellow mist floating up and around its hull. Within seconds, the vapor thickened to the consistency of a fog bank billowing and rolling across the surface of the bay. Faintly, he heard the steady throb of an engine. He could see only a blurry outline of the ship through the vapor shrouding the hull. He caught the acrid stench of sulfur. By now, magistrates ran in crazed confusion all around the stone-littered deck, stumbling over rocks, colliding with one another, screaming a babble of orders and counter-orders. A couple of them opened up with their sin-eaters, shooting toward the ships, though the range was far too great for hand blasters. Climbing halfway up the ladder, Ramirez opened the all-channel comlink frequency and shouted at the top of his lungs, "Man the cannons! Man the fucking cannons, you assholes!" A couple of mags scrambled to obey, scaling the ladders and dashing along the gangways to the shielded gun housings. From starboard of the lacquered ship bearing down on them erupted what appeared to be a shower of flaming meteors. They arced up over the water and down again. Ramirez blinked first in astonishment, then in derision. Fire arrows. Even with as much damage as the CG-47 had incurred, a shower of flaming arrows would have about as much effect on the armored ship as a handful of matchsticks. The flight of 3-foot-long arrows landed on the amidships deckwork, some falling short and dropping with little hisses into the bay. Others splintered against stone and metal. Ramirez ignored even the couple that thudded near him. He continued to bellow orders. "Get to the machine guns! Fire at will! Prep the landing buoy!" The last word of his order was drowned out by a brutal detonation. From somewhere behind him, a hellflower bloomed, petals of flame curving and spreading outward. Spewing from the end of every petal was a rain of shrapnel, ripping into bodies and bulkheads. A few fragments rattled violently against his armored back, knocking him from the ladder and onto all fours. The rolling echoes of the explosion faded, punctuated by screams of men in agony. The acrid chemical odor of high explosives filled his nostrils, and his belly lurched sideways. At least one of the flight of arrows had been tipped with a frag grin, and he knew it probably wouldn't be the only one flying their way. Despite the visor of her helmet, Brigid could see the cruiser bearing down on the Gamera Maru. The ship was still very fast, even with the damage she had taken not just from the rockfall, but from the frag grin. The turtle boat moved sluggishly, the hull seeming to drag. Clouds of sulfurous smoke spewed from the figurehead, so strong in odor she wondered how Kane and the handful of men aboard the ship could possibly stand it. Still, the smoke screen was effective. A stream of fire from the cruiser's MG emplacements did little more than punch holes in the vapor. It also provided cover for Dubois and his little sailboat, with its little packet of high explosive. At least she hoped the reason she couldn't see him was due to the smoke. If Dubois had reneged on his contribution to the little war, Kane would be more than disappointed. He would be enraged. He had spent hours creating a shaped charge from most of their grens. Brigid stood on the prow deck of the junk next to Shizuka, wearing Tigers of Heaven body armor with a copperhead slung over her shoulder. All of the men aboard the ship wore some form of armor, even those who weren't samurai, but volunteers from the new Aedoan citizenry. The volunteers wore hard leather cuirasses and were equipped with bows and full quivers. From the deck of the ship, it was a frightening spectacle. The awkward junks wallowed slowly toward the dark, streamlined cruiser. The new Aedoan vessels in the bay were trying to act as a barricade force, but they were having a hard time maneuvering. The winds weren't with them. However, the CG-47 didn't have much of an advantage either. With the wheelhouse crushed by several boulders, the ship drifted. The currents and tides were forcing the ship in close to the rocks at the base of the cliffs, where it was in danger of breaking up on submerged reefs or being beached. Shading her eyes, Brigid thought she spied Ramirez on deck. She resisted the impulse to look behind her to the keys. Shizuka shouted out orders, and her words were repeated until they reached the dozen archers lining the rail. In unison, they knocked their long arrows, bowstrings hummed simultaneously, and they loosed another flight of flaming arrows at the cruiser. They landed on its battered, stone-strewed deck, and within seconds came the crump of an explosion and a hot orange flash. The sound was different than the fragger, and Brigid knew that the grin this time was one that Kane had improvised out of a small ceramic jar filled with sulfur, saltpeter, and a sampling of chemicals borrowed from a grin in their war bags. Shizuka snapped out another order, and the man at the wheel obeyed instantly, but not quite fast enough. The junk began a starboard turn just as the twin cannons aboard the cruiser fired with ear-knocking reports. The double volley began with the forward cannon and stepped raggedly back toward the stern. The shell screamed across the surface of the bay and struck the junk's bow low, almost at the waterline. Brigid and Shizuka staggered backward, drenched by the geyser of water fountaining up over the side. Men went sprawling. Some stayed on their feet by clutching the deck rail. The second shell went into the quarterdeck, smashing wood, flinging deadly man-sized splinters. The jagged shards of broken timber slashed at the samurai in the vicinity. One man went down, folded around a long, sharp stake, his intestines oozing out along the point of bloody wood. As Brigid regained her balance, she saw the cruiser's tripod-mounted machine guns spit flickering spear points of flame. Steel-jacketed bullets sped across the rolling waves and sang through the rigging in the sails. The blastermen didn't have the range yet, and miniature waterspouts sprayed up just behind the junk's stern. The CG-47's cannon fired again, but the shell missed entirely, miraculously passing through the narrow, clear space between sail and mast and striking the water on the other side. The current slowly pushed the cruiser in a counterclockwise circle, moving the bore of the cannons away from their ship. The next thunderous volley soared up and over the bay and impacted on the shoreline. The shells reduced a large section of the newly erected palisade blockade to splinters. None of the magistrates aboard the cruiser seemed to notice the second, smaller junk cutting an oblique course toward their vessel. They weren't aware of its proximity until a flight of fire arrows hummed almost straight up and over the side of the CG-47. A series of small explosions lit up the cruiser's deck with little balls of orange-red flame. The machine gunners turned their aim toward the wooden ship, and a stream of bullets chewed through sails, rope, and flesh. Fist-sized holes appeared in the cloth, giving it the likeness of Swiss cheese. The archers on Shizuka's ship poured another hail of arrows onto the deck of the CG-47. Three explosions lit up the post-dawn gloom like flares, and dark smoke boiled up from the detonation points. The machine guns stopped chattering. The second junk drew alongside the cruiser, and coils of rope licked out, the grappling hooks catching fast on the port side forward. Heart pounding, her breath coming hard and fast, Bridget looked toward the turtle ship and saw it was completely concealed now by a pall of smoke that spread like streamers of filthy lace over the roiling surface of the bay. She couldn't even make out the haziest outline of Dubois' sailboat. The junk slid closer to the cruiser, and the two ships smashed together with a nerve-stinging crunch. The vessels were locked together, and though the cruiser's greater bulk overwhelmed the new Edoan ship, the junk rode slightly higher, and so the samurai didn't have to climb up to the deck. Unsheathed katanas in hand, voicing shrill, fierce cries, the Tigers of Heaven leaped down onto the cruiser. Nothing was calm and organized about boarding the cruiser. Bridget hadn't believed the samurai were in for an easy fight, and she was right. They were met, in the smoke on the cruiser's deck, by armored men every bit as fierce and deadly as the samurai. First, there were the cracks of blasters and the stutter of subguns. The first wave of boarders folded over, some falling between the ships to the bay. Then swords flashed and the slaughter commenced in earnest. Shizuka cried out commands, and laboriously the junk began to come about, moving toward the cruiser's starboard side. The ship foundered, wallowing and listing like a drunken dolphin. She stood immobile at the rail, one hand on the hilt of her katana, and the other resting on the pommel of her tanto. Her face was completely expressionless, except for the glitter in her dark eyes. A wild bullet fired from the cruiser thumped the air between them, and although Bridget instinctively ducked, Shizuka paid it no more attention than the buzzing of a gnat. Bridget contemplated warning Shizuka that just because the magistrates were occupied with her samurai, it didn't necessarily mean they wouldn't direct fire toward them. She realized Shizuka wasn't deliberately inviting injury. With her helmet's visor raised, she was showing herself to her followers, presenting the image of implacable determination, the very embodiment of Bushido, the way of the warrior, and Otoko Nimichi, the ancient and honorable code of the samurai. She didn't even appear to notice how the junk was taking on water. Bridget inhaled a deep, calming breath and stood beside her, figuring she could present the same example, at least outwardly. The deck was awash with looping liquid ribbons of scarlet, adding to its already slick quality. Several magistrates sprawled across it, their black polycarbonate exoskeletons sliced open, fluids leaking from the splits and gashes. On his knees behind a tumble of stone, Ramirez watched in incredulous horror as one of the armored boarders hacked off a mag's right arm at the elbow with a lightning-fast sword stroke. The man opened his mouth to scream, but the sword blade lifted, fell, and cleaved his helmet and the skull beneath it nearly in two. He realized now why they were called tigers, but they seemed to spring from hell, not from heaven. Other magistrates screamed in soul-deep terror as blades far sharper than razors licked out, inflicting deep wounds in their bodies. Ramirez saw one of the swordsmen make a whirling movement, and his sword cut wheels through the streamers of smoke. The edge of his blade sank into the junction of a man's jaw, and the magistrate's throat opened in a jetting of crimson. The same tiger caught sight of Ramirez and scuttled close, sword held at a right angle to his body, positioning himself for a decapitation. He laughed, an animal guttural sound like a throaty gargle. The cruiser lurched on a swell, staggering the tiger sideways for an instant. Ramirez drew up his knees in a protective gesture, fumbled with a copperhead he had picked up from the deck, and put the targeting pipper on the figure. The red kill dot bloomed on the breastplate like a tiny pinhead of blood. The tiger made a derisive snort and brushed at it, contemptuously, as if it were a piece of lint. Rage replaced Ramirez's fear, at least for a moment. With a howl of fury, he depressed the subgun's trigger, and a tri-burst stitched holes in the tiger's upper chest, knocking him backward and down. Realizing the armored killers were mortal, Ramirez rose to his feet. His training finally kicked in. He shifted the copperhead's barrel, retargeted, and fired again, the pipper flicking across a brass-colored back. The burst twisted the tiger's legs beneath his body in mid-stride, sending him flying headlong over the side.
"To me! Regroup! Regroup!"
Turning at the sound of Ramirez's voice, a masked and armored figure bounded toward him, sword held aloft. The pipper from Ramirez's auto-targeter touched the molded visor of the helmet. He stroked the copperhead's trigger, and the burst of 4.85mm steel-jacketed rounds pounded into the visor. The man struck a bulkhead wall, bounced off, and fell heavily to the deck, almost atop Ramirez. As Ramirez lifted himself above the corpse, he risked a swift glance over the heaped rocks. He saw a confusing turmoil of running shapes and smears of orange flame from weapons. From out of the shifting plains of dust and smoke plunged a howling mob of crazed magistrates, shrieking bloodthirsty cries. They fired their blasters as they came. The samurai swarmed to meet them like slinking shadows, moving with blurring speed in great leaps and bounds. The two forces crashed headlong into each other. Wherever a long blade touched a mag, it began to hack him apart. The magistrates shot, battered, and clubbed at the samurai in maniacal fury. But where one tiger of heaven fell, three of their own number went down. The magistrates finally set up a concentrated pattern of fire and began moving toward Ramirez. The racket of the fusillade was almost deafening, with half a dozen sin-eaters blasting all at once. The tigers took cover behind the wreckage littering the deck of the cruiser.
Into the boats! Assault force into the boats!
Then Ramirez glimpsed a flaming arrow arcing overhead, dropping between him and his men. He opened his mouth to scream a warning, but a thunderclap blast slammed his words back into his throat. Without hesitation, Ramirez dived forward. He hit the deck, going into a shoulder roll. He was still rolling when the area lit up in a red flash. Flying tongues of flame billowed outward. The detonation of the incendiary Gren hurled fire-wreathed bodies into the air, the concussion shattering bones and rupturing internal organs. The shock of the concussion slammed into Ramirez, bowling him over. As he somersaulted, he felt the brief wave of searing heat against his back. He elbowed himself over onto his back, his stunned eardrums registering little but a surf-like throb. A fine rain of pulverized pebbles and droplets of blood drizzled to the deck. Ramirez peered through the ragged scraps of smoke and settling dust. Two magistrates thrashed around in blind agony, screaming as they tried to beat out the flames on their clothes and hair. Using his elbows and the sides of his feet, Ramirez began crawling backward in the general direction of the landing boat berths. A shadow shifted in the plains of dust and smoke. Propping the copperhead's barrel on a rock, he fired a long burst. The multiple impacts smashed the mag sideways, and even as Ramirez recognized the black armor, the firing pin of his subgun clicked dry on an empty magazine. Rising to his feet, Ramirez ran Brokenfield style, blinking back the runnels of sweat sliding into his eyes. His breath burned hot and heavy in his throat. He heard the twang of bowstrings and the crack of shafts splintering on rock. The skin between his polycarbonate-sheathed shoulder blades crawled in anticipation of one of the long arrows planting its barbed head there. The rational segment of his mind knew an arrow couldn't possibly penetrate the armor. But rationally, the magistrates shouldn't be facing defeat from a numerically inferior and underarmed enemy, either. He sprinted half the distance to the landing boat berths before his ears registered a bone-jarring concussion. The CG-47 rocked violently, as if it had been struck from below by a monstrous wrecking ball. The white-red flash of an explosion belled up from the starboard bow. The shockwave picked him up and threw him down like a rag doll. The world seemed to be hammered apart under a series of blows in an explosion so violent and close, he thought for a crazed instant the cruiser would fly apart. Lifting his head, he saw an umbrella of black smoke rising in the sky, and his nostrils caught a sweetish whiff of high explosive. The metal deck plates under his body shivered with a prolonged vibration, and the entire ship tilted several degrees to port, sending him rolling. Clattering creaks and groans of overstressed metal surrounded him. He heard hull plates tearing with prolonged screeches and the gurgling of water rushing to fill a vacuum. Choking back bleats of terror and humiliation, Ramirez dragged himself forward by his elbows, then regained his feet and began a shambling, staggering run. He knew what had happened. Somehow, some way, an explosive device, a bomb or a mine, had been attached to the cruiser's hull. With his crew's attention diverted, it had been ridiculously easy for a slagger to float or swim close enough to plant the device. When Ramirez finally made it to the berths, he saw he wasn't the only mag with the same idea. A group of his men had already activated the hydraulic hoist and winch system to lower the pair of launches. Cables and grapnels were connected to the gunwales of the craft. Each of the boats was 12 feet long with high metal-reinforced sides. Outboard motors were clamped to the squared-off sterns. The men scrambled aboard both of the boats, taking orders from a man named Quint. Ramirez clambered aboard one carrying 8 men, and they regarded him with sour, contemptuous looks. He pretended not to notice.
"We've got to get back through the strait and head for one of the other islands."
No one responded to his declaration. With a creaking of the pulley mechanisms, the boats were smoothly lowered into the bay. Ramirez started the outboard with a single yank of the pull cord, while another mag snapped open and cast off the grapnel. He gunned the engine, the prow riding on a rush of foam. He paid no attention to the junk wallowing a few hundred yards away. He knew it was sinking. He cast an over-the-shoulder glance to the CG-47. A gaping cavity showed in her hull, and water cascaded into it. With a gurgling rumble, the cruiser settled low in the water. Ramirez swallowed hard. At a snarling cry from Quint in the other boat, he turned.
There's the son of a bitch who did it!
A small sailboat angled its way back toward the shoreline. An elderly, white-haired man held the tiller. When he saw he was the focus of their attention, he threw back his head and voiced a howl of malicious triumph. He thrust one arm up into the air, the middle finger extended in an ancient and unmistakable gesture. Lips peeled back over his teeth in a snarl of fury, Quint turned the bow of his craft toward the sailboat. Alarmed, Ramirez shouted after him, "What are you doing? Leave him! We've got to get out of here!" Quint ignored his words, gunning the engine. "That's an order!" Quint turned his head toward him.
"Fuck you and your orders!"
Tight-lipped, Kane took the helm from the man at the turtle boat's rudder and held it in a straight line, not bothering about current. Despite the scraps of smoke, his eyes had already spotted the mags abandoning the cruiser. Their craft would reach Dubois' sailboat about the same time as the Gamera Maru. The craft was making 15 knots now, but it wasn't fast enough for Kane. They were bearing down on the sailboat, and Dubois' back was to them. So absorbed was the man in shouting obscenities at the mag craft, he didn't see the approach of the turtle boat. His back was to them. Kane swung his helm to starboard, cutting a course that would head him directly for the landing craft instead of the sailboat. He shouted over the drone of the diesel engine to the four-man crew.
"Brace yourselves! I'm going to ram!"
A low mutter of dismay arose from the men, but they clutched davits and cleats and the edges of the benches. Even though they didn't care for the idea, they knew there was no other option. Their own weapons were at a grave disadvantage against the heavily armed magistrates. Chizuka's floundering junk managed to cut close behind Dubois's little craft, and Kane steered a course that would carry them past it on a collision course with the magboat. Dubois was still unaware of their approach. Kane saw Dubois rise, level a revolver at the boat, and stand there, awaiting death from the magistrates when they opened up with their weapons. Kane could spare the old man only a quick sideways glance, and his eyes flickered with admiration for the man's guts. Then he had no time for anything but the matter at hand. The crew of the landing boat suddenly noticed the Gamera Maru plunging out of the pall of smoke and directed a hail of machine gun fire at it. They had expected the junk to come close to the sailboat and take off its occupant. It never occurred to them that the crazy-looking boat would ram them. Cries of terror burst from the men aboard the magboat. A man with a copperhead abruptly sprang up and dived over the far side when he realized what Kane intended to do. The man at the wheel screamed at him to veer off. The crew added their own panic-shrill voices to his screams. They knew if their boat sank, their armor, as light as it was, would still be an impediment in the water. The rest of the man's shout was overwhelmed by the shattering crash of the impact of the turtle boat's ramming sprit against the landing boat. The prow of the boat splintered, planks wrenching, groaning, and tearing in splinters twice as long as a man. Kane reversed the engines, and the propeller of the Gamera Maru churned up great geysers of water as it dragged the vessel astern. There was another great rending crash, and the turtle boat dragged itself clear of the mag launch, its prow-mounted ram sliding out and leaving a huge raw wound in the craft's side. The bay rushed into the space the prow opened up, and the boat listed to port. A couple of the black-armored crew toppled over into the bay, but the others clung to the sides. With appalling quickness, the enemy boat seemed to be swallowed down into the dark water as if dragged by 1,000 undersea hands. The turtle boat kept churning astern, and Kane ordered a line thrown over the side. One of his men lifted a wooden hull frame and tossed a coil of rope to the sailboat. Dubois caught it, winding the hawser twice around a cleat. Taking the sailboat in tow, the Gamera Maru headed toward the crippled junk. Somehow, its crew had kept the ship from sinking, though she listed low in the water. Kane saw Bridget and Shizuka standing at the highest point in the bow, but they weren't looking at him. Kane turned to follow their gaze. The second junk of the flotilla moved away from the CG-47, having cut its grappling lines. The cruiser, with a hissing gurgle, sank beneath the surface of the bay, leaving a great round saucer of suction that dragged debris and bodies with it. At the sight, the crews of all three ships cheered wildly. Dubois took Shizuka and Bridget aboard his boat. The crew of the ship remained aboard, pumping and bailing until her sister junk arrived and hooked up tow lines. They laboriously rowed back to the quays. The new Aedoans greeted them with cheers of unrestrained jubilation and improvised dance steps of joy. Kane, Bridget, Dubois, and Shizuka walked a gauntlet of bowing, handshaking people, their faces wet with tears of joy and relief. The artillery fire from the CG-47 had taken only a modest toll. Three new Aedoans were dead and two seriously wounded. Nine others suffered injuries from minor to incapacitating, but none of these were life-threatening, only burns and shrapnel cuts. They drank victory cups of stinging sake, and within 20 minutes, Grant appeared out of breath, dirty and glowering as if angry or disappointed. Usually, the deeper his scowl, the more satisfied he was with the situation, and his scowl was very deep.
A boatload of the bastards got away.
We know. They probably won't make it through the strait.
They made it, and Ramirez was with them.
Shizuka's lips compressed.
We'll hunt them down, Grant-san. Do not fear they shall escape us.
I don't doubt you'll hunt them down. I just wish you wouldn't.
Shizuka shot him a glare of incredulous outrage.
We can't let them return to the Baron and report what they saw.
No, we can't. I wasn't proposing that we do. I'm requesting that you and your tiger stand down and let us deal with them.
He gestured to himself, Bridget, and Kane. Shizuka's dark eyes widened in surprise. Then she nodded in sudden understanding. When the Tigers of Heaven had tracked down the magistrates responsible for the Port Morninglight massacre, many of them were tortured to death. She remembered Kane's and Grant's objection to the samurai version of justice.
Very well. You should not have any great difficulty locating them on the open sea, even in Gamera-maru.
Bridget removed her helmet and shook her mane of hair free.
I don't think they'll strike out for the mainland in broad daylight. They'll find a place to hole up, to tend to their wounds and wait for dark.
Hole up where? They're out of the strait, so...
He broke off, comprehension gleaming in his eyes.
There is only one place. Ikazuchi Kojima. Thunder Isle.